Well, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus has entered Jerusalem. He has told a few stories. And as usual, stories create questions, and so there are people asking him questions. The Pharisees, who really are the party closest to Jesus, ask him some questions. And then the Sadducees, another group that he's not so associated with, ask him some questions. And then we come to our question today. It's not an unusual question for someone to ask a rabbi. In fact, disciples of a rabbi often were known to ask, which is the greatest commandment? And the rabbi might answer at different times in different ways so that the disciple could learn the importance of each commandment. But that is not the spirit in which this question is asked. This is a trap. The person asking it is an expert in the law, the Torah. He is asking this question in an attempt to trip Jesus up. Because you see, there are 613 commandments according to the ancient rabbis. Now, I've not counted them all, but I'll take their word for it. We usually just deal with the top 10, right? But there are 613, and so any commandment that Jesus might choose, the questioner could ask, well, why didn't you choose a different commandment? If Jesus chose, thou shalt not covet, then the questioner could say, what about murder? If Jesus chose murder, what about idolatry? You see how the trap works? But Jesus is pretty smart when it comes to folks trying to trap him. So he goes back to the book that they both share, the book that we share with them, the first five books of our Bible called the Torah. And he chooses two commandments, one out of Deuteronomy, one out of Leviticus, out of his own tradition and the questioner's tradition, because they're both Jewish. And he says, first, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And the second is exactly like it. Now, the questioner only asked for one, but Jesus is choosing two. Jesus says the second is just like it. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. In these two commandments, you find a summary of all of the law and all of the prophets. It's a summary of Scripture, those two commandments. You notice that the questioner doesn't follow up the conversation. He's left silenced. Because Jesus' summary really goes to the heart of who we are, who he was, and what we're all called to do. Now, we're beginning a series on Mr. Wesley's general rules. And those three rules are do no harm, do good, and attend to the ordinances of God, or practice those practices that keep us close to God. We're beginning to deal with do no harm today. And we don't set out to do harm necessarily, but often we do it without thinking, without even knowing sometimes. And this text is a way for us to keep coming back to what is central and to avoid doing harm, because if you love God with your heart and soul and mind, and if you love your neighbor as yourself, you can pretty much avoid doing harm, right? First of all, loving yourself. Loving yourself is not selfishness. Those are two entirely different things, okay? Selfishness is wanting to get what someone else has. Selfishness requires that we put other people on a lower plane than we are, to put people down. I find that selfish people generally are people who don't love themselves. And because they don't love themselves, they feel like they have to put other people down, or they have to try to fill that void in their lives with stuff. But people who love themselves in this manner, the way Jesus is speaking of it, are people that we tend to call those who are comfortable in their own skin. Another word might be authentic. What you see is what you get. They don't have to pretend. They don't have to put anybody down. They don't have to accumulate a lot of stuff to try and prove that they're important. They love themselves, and we are called to love ourselves, not because we're smart, not because we're good looking, not because of our place in society. We're called to love ourselves because God loved us first. It's that simple. We are beloved children of God. And if we ever really got hold of that idea, that in itself might keep us from doing harm to ourselves or to others or to what God is doing in the world. Because you see, we can love ourselves as beloved children of God because God's done it already. Not because we're perfect, we're not. Not because we necessarily will ever be perfect, but simply because God has chosen to love each and every person on the planet unconditionally, expansively. Which leads to the next step, and that is loving your neighbor as yourself. If you love yourself because you're a child of God, then we don't love our neighbor because they're particularly smart or good-looking or their position in society. We're able to love them because they are beloved children of God, just like us. Every single one. The ones you like and the ones you don't like so much. The ones who live in your household. Because sometimes it's harder to love the people we love than to love the people we don't know, isn't it? I had a professor once, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again because it is central to my understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about love. But my professor, Taylor McConnell, once told me, you know, love is not a feeling. Love is a policy. Love is how you choose to treat other people, and it doesn't matter how you may feel about them. You treat them as if they were beloved children of God because, you see, God loved them first, too. And then the third thing is not to do harm to what God is doing in the world. God is active in the world doing good. God is not here to do harm. We sometimes do harm in God's name because when we don't love our neighbors, when we don't even love our brothers and sisters of the same faith tradition or our brothers and sisters who are United Methodists even, when we go around quarreling, when we go around defaming them, we're doing harm. Not just to them, not just to us, but to what God is doing in the world. When we decide that the appropriate way to respond to violence is with more violence because that will end the violence, which it never has, we are doing harm to what God is doing in the world. Because you see, on those few occasions when folks have responded nonviolently to violence, I think of the civil rights movement. We've been remembering a lot about that during this past year and even this past couple of weeks. When people responded nonviolently to violence, it worked. It's not that Jesus' way of doing things won't work. It's that we're afraid to try it. And so we don't try it, and we don't give it a chance. When we don't give Jesus' way of responding a chance, we're doing harm to what God is about in the world. So our whole idea is to try to avoid harming ourselves, because after all, we're beloved children of God. Harming others, because after all, they're beloved children of God. And in doing that, harming what God is attempting to do creatively, actively, in the world. Behold, I am making all things new, Jesus says. If we believe that, then it's our job to take part in that creativity and that newness. I want to tell you a story. Now, there's a surprise, huh? This is an old folk tale, and you'll recognize the plot line. The folk tale is sometimes called Cap of Rushes, sometimes called Rushy Cape, sometimes called like meat loves salt and sometimes called like bread loves salt. It's a very, very old story. It has to do with a king who has three daughters. He goes on a trip. Before he goes, he asks them what kind of dresses they want. The two elder daughters describe elaborate dresses with lots of jewels that he gets for them. The youngest of the three asks for just a simple plain white dress, which he gets for her. But when he's about to distribute the dresses, he decides he'll have a contest to see which of the daughters loves him the most. So before he gives them each dress, he invites them to come and tell him how much they love him. And oh, the first two daughters are effusive. Oh, we love you more than the stars and the moon. We love you to the moon and back. And on and on and on they went. And Daddy loved it. Don't you know it? He was very happy to give them their dresses. And then we come to the youngest daughter. And when he asks her how much she loves him, she says, Daddy, I love you like meat loves salt. Or in some stories, like bread loves salt. Well, that didn't make any sense to him. He said, what about the sun and the moon and the stars? Come on. Your sisters did a pretty good job of this. You're falling behind. She said, I love you as much as I possibly can, but one day I'll meet someone else and I will go and I'll live with them and make a life with them. It won't mean that I love you any less. Well, this infuriated the king. He threw the dress at her and said, you're banished, you're disowned, go your way. So to reward the two daughters who were so effusive, he divided his kingdom between the two of them. He went to live with the oldest. Pretty soon he started getting on the oldest daughter's nerves. If you can imagine a father getting on a daughter's nerves. You can stretch your imagination that far, I bet. She gets rid of his servants. And finally, when he has frustrated her to the point that she can't stand it anymore, she shifts him over to the second daughter, who puts him in a back part of her castle, feeds him the scraps, whatever's left over, because he frustrates her too. Now, while all of this is happening, the youngest of the three daughters puts on her white dress, and so she won't sully the white dress. She gets rushes, or in the way I tell it, iris fronds, and she makes a cape out of them to cover the white dress, so that no one can see what she's wearing underneath. She goes to find work. The only work she can find is in the kitchen of a castle, where she has to do the most menial work and sleeps next to the fire. And of course, in this part of the story, there are a series of balls. She takes off her rush cape, her iris cape, and she goes to the balls, and of course she meets royalty, and she too marries royalty, like her sisters. We know that story, don't we? The mistreatment of his older daughters drives the old king mad. And so he one day leaves his second daughter's castle and wanders in the world in his madness. You recognize the story now? It's King Lear. I'm not sure if this folk tale preceded Shakespeare's telling or came after, because it's in the oral tradition, we don't know, but it's basically the same story. In his madness, he happens to wander into a thicket near the castle where the youngest daughter lives. One of her servants finds him there, brings him in the house. She recognizes him immediately, even in his disheveled state, but he doesn't know her. In his madness, he doesn't remember her at all. She takes him in, she cares for him, makes sure that the servants clean him up and put fine clothes on him and feed him good food to strengthen him. And he just sits across the table and stares blankly at her. Until one evening, she tells the cook, I want you to prepare the bread, but I want you to prepare it without salt. And I want you to prepare the meat, and I want you to prepare it without salt. And so that evening, they sat to eat just like every other evening. When the old king took the bread and broke it and put it in his mouth, it was terrible. He spit it out. When he cut a piece of meat and put it in his mouth, it just wasn't the way he had expected. But somewhere in the recesses of his madness, he heard a voice saying, like meat loves salt, like bread loves salt. And when he looked up, he recognized the person sitting across the table from him. It was his youngest daughter. Well, in this story, unlike in Lear, once he recognizes her, they live happily and well for a long, long time. But this story makes me wonder, which of the sisters are we? We who come on Sunday morning and express our love effusively for God. We sing songs to God and we read scriptures and some guy gets up and flails his arms around and tells stories about God. And we all say, oh, we just love you so much, God. And then, you know, by the time we get home, we've kind of forgotten that and the rest of the week is all about us. Are we those sisters? Does God just kind of get in the way the rest of the week and frustrate us? Because you see, God is always there to remind you that you are a beloved child, but so is that person you don't like so much or who doesn't like you. God is always there to remind you that there may be a better way to go about walking through this world if we would just stop and pay attention. Or are we the daughter who simply goes through the world telling the truth, not unkindly, but simply telling the truth, doing the ordinary everyday things that mean love? Too often when we talk about loving others, we talk about the heroes of faith, the Mother Teresas. Very few of us are going to be Mother Teresa. Very few. And so it's very easy for us to say, well, you know, I can never be that, so we'll just forget this loving other people business. My very first book I published years and years and years ago, a little book called Friends for Life, had 52 stories, a story for every week, some from the Old Testament, some from the New Testament, some from the history of the church, and some from modern day. And after it had come out, one of the editors of one of the major United Methodist publications and I happened to meet, and this editor said, you know, I read your book and I was pretty disappointed. I was grateful for his forthrightness. He said, you know, I read that book and I thought, you know, this isn't so hard to do. Anybody can do this. And I said, did you ever think that might be just exactly what I intended? Because you see, if they read that book and they said, hey, this Michael Williams, he's wonderful, I could never do that, it wouldn't have served any purpose. But if they read it and they said, you know, this isn't so hard, I could do this, I could tell these stories, then I would have accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. Not many of us are going to be Mother Teresa, and quite frankly, it's probably a good thing. Because what we need are those people who go about their lives in such an ordinary way that we look at them and we say, I could do that. I could live that kind of faithfulness. I could love myself and others and God in that way. And in doing so, cease to do harm as much as possible, as far as it is in my power. That is the example we have, and that is the example we're called to offer. Thanks be to God.